two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why, hello there. It's your old pal, Sarah Silverman, and I'm back with a brand new season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast. On my podcast, I am talking about everything. Politics? Yeah, we get into it. Favorite sandwich shop in L.A.? I know a few spots, and I'm going to tell you about them. I'm also going to be talking to you. I will be reacting and responding to listener voicemails in real time. Let me tell you, things can get weird, and I love every second of it. Weird is my comfort zone. The newest season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Welcome to The Bubble. This is your host, Andy Slavitt. It is now Monday, or whatever day it is when you're listening to this podcast. We have a lot going on around the world, as we know. And today we're going to talk about the things that are going on around the world with regard to the pandemic. And the pandemic, we're so used to using interchangeably with COVID-19, or at least I am. But this last week's been a reminder that there are other public health outbreaks out there. And in fact, on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about one of them, which is a new outbreak of monkeypox. And many folks may not even have heard of monkeypox before this last week. So we'll be talking that through on Wednesday, explaining what's happening, what to be worried about. There's a little to be concerned about. And I think particularly if you're worried about if you're the type of person that worries about other people, there may be a little less to worry about in regard to your individual health. This is a little bit less of a stealthy virus, but it is concerning, and we'll talk about it. We'll make sure you have all the information that you need. There are cases in the U.S., and that's no joke. Today, we're going to talk with Catherine Wu from The Atlantic. She's a great reporter. We've had her on the show before. She's a super explainer. She's been looking at many of the current hot issues that should be on our minds. And I want to just spend a second before we get into this interview to give you some of my thinking about how we should be thinking about what's on our minds. I mean, look, the things that we look out the window and talk about today, the cases, the hospitalizations, the deaths, etc., those are all really important to look at because, you know, they tell us how to stay safe. They tell us what we should be worried about. But we largely can't do much about it. We can do things to keep ourselves safe and people we love safe. But we can't do anything to prevent a wave that's currently here. The only way we can really think about things that we can do that are actionable is to look at the things that might be happening 4 or 5 months from now, because it's really the things that are happening 4 or 5 months ago that generated the wave we're seeing today, the emergence of new variants of Omicron. And it's the things that are happening today and that if we pay attention to, we can influence. That'll have an impact on what happens in the fall, in the winter. And it's that very thing that I think is really important to pay attention to, because there's some weird things going on around the world we should pay attention to. Number one, the frequency of variants coming out of South Africa and the nature of those variants, what they look like. Number two, the events in China and to a different degree, North Korea, taking countries that have been closed and had zero COVID policies and are largely unvaccinated. There is a dam about to break in China that, much like the first time we saw COVID in China, soon impacted us greatly. The same could be true again. We have a witch's brew of factors, older people that haven't been vaccinated, people that have been in doors a virus that is spreading way too rapidly for the Chinese authorities, even with their lockdowns, to prevent from happening. And similar and even more dire circumstances in North Korea. We could see millions of deaths in those two countries alone. And furthermore, we could see a spillover effect with the increased pace, even more changes and more surprises in the virus. And it's important that we look at it and understand it. I wouldn't say that today is one of the most optimistic episodes you're going to hear. And it's not really intended to be optimistic or pessimistic. It's really an exploration of the facts and some of the things going on. And I don't mean to leave you with additional worries that you didn't have coming into the podcast. That is not the purpose of the podcast. In fact, you know, I believe that information, knowledge, and understanding will ultimately reduce our fears and our need to worry. Getting those facts right, getting the right information, not misinformation, from reliable sources like Catherine are helpful. But I will tell you that there are some new things on the horizon here that are worth paying attention to defeat. And a lot of it also comes down to this battle between science and the virus. You know, the virus, from an evolutionary perspective, spends efforts to outsmart the protective measures that we take. We put forward protective measures to try to outsmart the virus. And it's kind of a wily contest that goes back and forth. And I just want to tell you that science will ultimately win. I 100% believe that. There's nothing that's so clever about this virus that the more we understand it, that our scientists can't understand it better. That doesn't mean that there won't be periods of time when it won't feel like the virus is getting the best of us. And in China and North Korea right now, what's happening in South Africa, I think it's important to say science has work to do. And by the way, that science doesn't just extend to what happens in the lab, it extends to how that science gets implemented in the real world. Because we can create the best vaccine in the world, but if no one takes it, it doesn't do any good. And you know, that's in part what we're dealing with in North Korea and in China right now. And I'm really fearful for what we're going to see in those countries and the loss of life alone, even with the fact that we can protect ourselves well from what we see and will continue to. I think these are things we need to watch, and I'm grateful that Catherine came on to talk about it with us. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. How are you, Andy?
I'm good, thank you. It's been a little while.
It has. Millions and millions of eons in pandemic time.
Right.
I'm good. I guess it's another year, another chapter of this.
Another chapter. That's probably where we should start, I guess. First of all, I love your reporting, and I love your writing, even separately from your reporting. I think it might be interesting to just begin by asking the simple question of having you paint the picture of where we are now in this chapter. What are the realities we're learning about Omicron? And, you know, how should we be feeling? What should be our temperature check?
You call this question simple, right? Yeah, it is a great question. And I'm actually going to parse it apart by how we're actually defining we. I suspect that you and I belong to a cadre of people for whom we could say the pandemic is going a lot better. If I were to get sick, I could probably, you know, do pretty well. I might be able to get my hands on some treatments, some tests very, very quickly and feel pretty good about my risk being super low. I'd be able to isolate. I'd be able to protect my family and not worry all that much because I know I have my vaccine and my booster behind me. I know that the hospitals locally are pretty well equipped to treat me, and that would be great. If I expand we out to the U.S., I don't know. I don't feel that great about things right now. It's certainly not the worst place we've ever been, but cases are absolutely rising. Hospitalizations are luckily not following suit to quite the same extent, but I am worried about the lower lower severity implications. And then if we go all the way out to the we of the world, I'd say things are still looking pretty bad. We don't have to look that far outside of this country to figure out that the pandemic is absolutely still raging, and it is looking terrible in some parts of the world that are under-vaccinated and don't have access to some of the resources that we do.
It feels like there's reason to feel like, okay, things are getting back to normal. We have, as you say, the tools, the vaccines, the boosters, the therapies, better knowledge of how to treat things so that we don't have to be all consumed. And then there are these kind of probably moments of panic or anxiety or uncertainty, because we kind of have been trained to see that we don't know what's going to happen 90 days out from now at any point. Is that the right way to be feeling? Like we're just caught in between without really having a sense of what's to come?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I definitely feel like I am living with a lot of uncertainty right now. You know, things do feel better, and I do think we can afford to appreciate how far we've come and how much better off we are in terms of like having the tools, as you say. But I think, you know, there's one extreme where we feel 100% certain and 100% complacent, and another extreme where we live in constant chaos and are anxious and terrified all the time. And I don't want us at either extreme. I think people have a lot stronger sense now of what risks they feel comfortable taking, of, you know, how to sort of navigate all this day-to-day uncertainty. But it is still really exhausting. It's a lot to deal with. And I fully appreciate how fed up people are at this point, with reading all of these headlines, with being surprised and caught off guard every day. I totally get the impulse to want to check out of this.
Well, let's talk about that uncertainty a little bit. I think for a while, our conception was, okay, this will someday be over. There will be back to normal. Then I think we adjusted to, okay, maybe there's no such thing as herd immunity because the virus will persist, but maybe it's getting milder and maybe it'll be like the flu or seasonal for people who are vaccinated and boosted. And then increasingly, there seems to be a different sense of things with Omicron. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how you're thinking about it, about a virus that's continually evolving, not seasonal, and that as it reacts to all of the blanket immunity or levels of immunity, it's adapting to be a kind of a constant and more frequent part of our life, like a really bad common cold that doesn't go away, just keeps circulating. That's pretty scary.
That notion definitely is scary, but I don't think we yet have a guarantee that that is what it's going to be like. I think we could eventually see that this does settle into a more predictable seasonal pattern. It may look kind of like flu, where we have, you know, a big fat winter surge roughly every year in the northern and southern hemisphere. It could be biannual, like we get, you know, some sort of summer surge, some sort of winter surge. It could continue to be sort of like this, but each wave being a little smaller than we have now. I don't think we have a good sense of how predictable that is. I mean, we have other viruses that circulate through the population and aren't perfectly seasonal. So there's a lot of precedent that could pave the path here. But I think what is likely to happen is that waves will get less frequent, waves will get less intense. I just can't say anything about the exact cadence or the magnitude right now. And it may still take quite a bit of time for things to settle, and things may not settle to the same degree in different parts of the world.
Okay, so let's get into that. I think it's good to start with how we're feeling, because that's a good pulse check. But then maybe let's get into some of the facts. So maybe we'll take a bit of a tour. Can you start with what we're seeing and learning about the Omicron evolution, what we're seeing and how it behaving in South Africa, and what that suggests about what we're likely to continue to see here in this sort of Omicron period that we're in?
Yeah, and it's interesting to call it the Omicron period because it does seem like Omicron has been on a bit of a roll lately. Like we're getting all of these subvariants that all sort of belong to this lineage. And we haven't really totally seen that before. You know, before we had Alpha that was replaced by Delta, which was replaced by Omicron, but they weren't directly giving rise to each other. You know, Delta was not a descendant of Alpha, Omicron was not a descendant of Delta. But then Omicron arrived and now it's just splintering off into all these successful subvariants that all kind of belong to roughly the same branch of the family tree. And that's pretty interesting. You know, I know that this is something that you've talked about before, but we have this idea of like ladder-like evolution with other viruses like the flu. You know, this year's successful strains beget next year's successful strains beget next year's successful strains. It's not always perfectly like that, but there's this sort of stepwise ratcheting forward of evolution that makes it a lot easier to sort of get a sense of where the next threat might be coming from, and also importantly, how to design our next vaccines. There's more predictability there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's possible that this may be the start of this happening with this coronavirus, but, you know, pretty much everyone I've been talking to has been a little wary of saying, oh, we've got our flu-like evolution. This could just be, you know, the virus continuing its sort of radial starburst pattern, less ladder-like and more like, you know, spokes erupting out of a center of a bicycle wheel. But this spoke just happens to be kind of a longer one, one that it really, really likes. And it's going to be a fat spoke, but in a few months, we could easily get another Greek letter. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that even though all of these, you know, BA 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 variants do technically fall under the Omicron umbrella, they're really different from each other. The virus definitely hasn't given up on its strategy of, you know, changing its appearance to get around our antibodies and other parts of our immunity. You know, the differences between, say, like BA4, BA5, and BA1, they're huge. Arguably, you know, some of those differences could warrant giving some of the BAs their own Greek letter.
So let's talk about this evolutionary battle that seems to be going on between the virus and our attempts to defend ourselves from the virus. What is happening? Who's winning that battle? And what very precisely do we know about what the virus and these various Omicron lineage forms is doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's messy, and I would hesitate to declare a victor anytime soon. I guess I sort of picture it as a really extended race, and I have no finish line here in mind. The virus is certainly mutating at a pace that we can't really totally keep up with, especially not with our vaccines.
And if this is a reaction to so much vaccination and so much prior infection, is this the bug saying, hey, wait a minute, I've got to start to evolve differently?
Yeah, I think sometimes it's pretty easy to anthropomorphize this thing, but truly it is just going about its way. It is mutating randomly, and sometimes those random mutations give it an advantage that help it get around some of our immune defenses, and that is what takes off. There is no purposefulness here. There is no virus being like, oh God, I'll look at all these vaccinated people. I know what to do about that. Throughout this entire pandemic, the virus has really had one goal, keep infecting people, keep infecting as many people as quickly as possible. Early on in the pandemic, no one was immune, and the virus had a ton of success just being fast. Speed was really enough to get it by, move from person to person as quickly as you can. But now that more and more people are immune, speed is not really enough anymore. And it's sort of switching to this regime of stealth. How do we sort of get around people's defenses? That is what is helping the virus still spread as fast as it is spreading.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
And so let's talk about our response, our scientific response. You know, one of the benefits that we always talk about the mRNA platform is how adaptable it is, how we can slot in different iterations, if you will, of the vaccine and adjust it as the virus adjusts, which should allow us to take this competition to the next place. You've written, I think, a great piece about this, which we will, of course, link to in the notes to the show. But could you describe a little bit about what you see happening and what the challenge of creating a vaccine to combat this side of wily survival-oriented viruses?
Yeah, so I think it's actually useful to turn back to flu as a comparator here. So every year we update the flu vaccine, and we have about 6 or so months of lead time to do that. The flu vaccine technology is slower. It takes more time to update than mRNA vaccines. But there's enough predictability in how the flu spreads. You know, we get a northern hemisphere wave and then a southern hemisphere wave. And so we get a sense of what's spreading on the other side of the world. Let's put that in the flu vaccine for this hemisphere this year. As we talked about earlier, we don't really have that predictability with SARS-CoV-2. We don't have that much lead time. And even though the mRNA platforms are a lot faster, you know, I think some Pfizer's best estimates are that we can feasibly get an update to a vaccine within about 100 days. That has not been fast enough. I mean, Pfizer did start that process when Omicron was first detected in Botswana and South Africa back in November.
But we're way past 100 days.
Yeah, we're way past 100 days, and we don't have an Omicron vaccine. An Omicron vaccine, a BA1 vaccine, is being slotted for fall, and BA1 is pretty much gone. It's out the door.
And so this is what you write about, which is, you know, even with this quote-unquote speed, you know, it's not 7 years, it's months, whatever, whatever we want to say about the platform, as a practical execution matter, they start working on this in November with BA1. They can make the vaccine quickly, but they've got to run a whole bunch of tests on people. By the time they get done running these tests and evaluating data, BA1 is history.
Right.
History. They went to BA2, BA212, BA215, BA4, whatever, BA Pi, whatever you want to call it. We're like not in that mode anymore. And so how do we keep up with this, and what should be the right strategy for developing a new vaccine for the fall of the U.S., which is what I think we all anticipate?
Right. So this is, I think, incredibly messy. I do think that if we do continue to update these vaccines regularly, which could become an annual thing like we do for flu, it will go faster in future iterations. We won't necessarily have to have trials that are this protracted. We may be able to have smaller trials. And, you know, once I think the gears are oiled in all these vaccine companies, these updates can come faster. But, you know, as we're pointing out, it's probably never going to be as fast as the virus is evolving. It's tricky. I think we can expect that with growing immunity, there's a very good chance that the virus will slingshot variants our way at a slower clip, but I wouldn't count on it necessarily. So what do we do if we're always a few steps behind? It feels like we're kind of playing variant whack-a-mole and the virus is 8 steps ahead of us every single time. I think there are, you know, ideas in the pipeline. You know, a lot of people have been thinking about what if we spray vaccines up our noses and will that do a better job at preventing transmission and infection? Will that help slow down viral evolution? Will that keep cases down? Will it have these knock-on effects so that we're keeping pace a little bit better? Another idea is to, you know, sort of cram a bunch of different versions of spike proteins into the same shot, maybe teach the body a ton of breadth at once. And if we sort of design those shots correctly, there could even be, you know, a universal aspect to them. It could teach the body to, in theory, anticipate or, you know, recognize variants that don't even exist yet. And that would be really incredible. It would give us breadth in one fell swoop. I think those are really promising ideas, but we don't have those yet. So I think this fall might be a little rough. Next fall might be a little rough.
Those are 5 to 10 year ideas, they sound like to me.
Yeah.
Which is to say, like, in this battle of science against the virus, if I were going to make my long-term bet, I bet on science. But I would also say that at any given moment, the virus could be leading. And right now, I think we're in a period where the virus is winning. And in these battles, it feels like we're seeing, if this year is any guide, you know, we maybe see COVID-19 three times a year, right? I mean, it's only 4 months or so between the South African cycles, 4 to 6 months, right? So 2 to 3 times a year, a wave 2 to 3 times a year would be a very different future than a once a year flu cycle.
It would. I don't think we have a guarantee that that's what things are going to be like. You know, we are still very much in the pandemic.
I want a guarantee. I want a guarantee. I want one guarantee of something.
I think we can guarantee that the virus is going to stick around in some form for at least a while. But
there we go. Thank you. Thank you. Like, it's like I feel like the genie that rubbed the bottle and asked and then made the wrong wish.
I mean, this is messy, right? And like, I will be the first one to admit this sucks. We are getting so much more of, we are getting so many more waves than I think anyone would like. But, you know, I don't want people to be afraid that they're going to be doomed to be reinfected 3 times a year in perpetuity for the rest of their lives. We don't really have anything that does that. But, you know, the longer we keep ourselves in the pandemic, I think the more frequently those things will happen.
I want to ask you one other question about the vaccines before we move on. And I've asked this question of Peter Marks. I asked it of the CEO of Pfizer and Moderna, and also Ashish Jha recently, and I guess Rob Califf. So I'll ask you as well. Do we think we ever have a hope of getting back to a vaccine? And by ever, I mean this next cycle, that not only prevents hospitalizations and deaths, but can be effective at preventing infection and preventing, essentially then preventing much more contagion?
There's always the chance. But I think with this next cycle, in the nearest term future, it's going to be really difficult. We're still relying on the same technology. And as we've talked about, we're still going to be a few steps behind with regard to viral evolution. I think even if we slotted BA1 into our shots right now, there is going to be some trickiness. The variants that are starting to dominate here in the US and other parts of the world, they are able to get around some of the defenses raised by BA1 infections, and they are able to get around some of the defenses raised by the original recipe vaccines. And, you know, obviously it is wonderful that our vaccines are still preventing severe disease and death, but it is incredibly difficult for any vaccine to prevent symptoms and infection really, really, really long term. And I think that means we are probably going to have to turn to additional technologies, different types of vaccines, or look outside of vaccines if we really want to keep transmission down long term.
I think where we'll go next is maybe continue to just talk about what's happening in other parts of the world. If you have some thoughts, it is interesting that South Africa appears to be the place that is where at least they're having the first discoveries of the first cycles, and then things move here. But there's other things happening in other parts of the world which are interesting and worth watching. There are a set of the zero COVID countries, which, you know, were effective for a variety of reasons for a long, long time in holding off COVID from coming to their shores in earlier iterations. North Korea, you know, Australia for a time, New Zealand for a time, China because of its policies. And, you know, now, given what's happened around the globe, they're now dealing with the introduction of a much more contagious version. And in many of those cases, they have very low vaccination rates or less effective vaccines. It feels like a dangerous recipe, not just for those countries, which is sad enough, but also for the evolutionary potential of the virus, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the countries that you're mentioning, you know, North Korea and China especially, they are definitely in very, very precarious spots right now. You know, we've seen them have huge outbreaks. You know, China is sort of coming off of one. North Korea's is really just starting right now. And I am really concerned about what's going on over there. I think especially because of the low vaccination rates, especially among elderly people in China and pretty much everyone in North Korea, as far as we're aware. You know, this virus now moves way too fast that we can't sustainably keep it out of our population. This is probably going to become a forever virus for us. And while those strategies maybe had some sense early on in the pandemic when cases were still extremely, extremely low and not spreading at this speed across the world, this is not a sustainable policy, not against the virus and not for the people who have to weather its effects.
So what's going to happen? Well, maybe you could start with what's happening now, to your knowledge and reporting, in China and in North Korea, and tell us how you see that evolving.
Yeah, so, you know, to my understanding, you know, North Korea, I guess I can start there. There is a huge outbreak going on there right now. And I think, you know, they're calling them fever cases, sort of euphemistically. Pretty much no one is vaccinated because the country refused vaccine and vaccines and aid from other countries. And we know there are a lot of vulnerable people there. The country has a malnutrition problem. There are many parts of the country that don't have access to good medical resources. This is going to be very, very, very bad. And I think this is a real demonstration of probably two things. You know, having an unvaccinated population that is unfortunately a failure to prepare, to take proactive preventive measures, to steal a population against a virus. And, you know, we've got a lot of unfortunately skewed messaging about, you know, how quote-unquote mild variants of Omicron are. And this is a real proof that that is absolutely not the case. When you have a population that doesn't have immunity, a virus can absolutely rip through it and cause immense debilitating disease and death. The reason that hospitalizations have dropped in other parts of the world is largely because immunity has built up. But where it's lacking, we're not seeing that effect.
It's a really sad but interesting scientific case study to look at the question of, is it that it is getting more mild, or is it that we are getting better layers of protection? Because North Korea is sitting, as you say, in a place where it doesn't have, it's been a closed country, they haven't vaccinated, and they're facing this. And when all is said and done, if you look at those death rates, the IFR, and it looks like it did in the 2020 version here in the U.S., it will be sort of a relatively definitive piece of evidence, won't it, that it's actually not getting more mild. We're just getting, it's just moving away from a novel virus to something that we have various levels of protection against.
Right. And, you know, definitely the fear is that if we continue to let this virus spread as it has in some of these countries that we're talking about, we are going to see more variants. And there's no guarantee that the next one we see is going to be mild, milder, any iteration of that word. It could be more severe. It could be worse than Delta, which is arguably the worst iteration of the virus we've seen so far in terms of severity.
Right. And as you said earlier, if you were going to give it human characteristics again, you'd say it does naturally look for ways to overcome the kind of immunity that we put up, not necessarily to kill us, because that's not a great recipe for the virus either. But, you know, our defenses are something that it seems to be adapting to. What about China? That's a really fascinating, scary situation and one of these kinds of dilemmas that I can't figure out what to do.
Yeah, I mean, they continue to double down on their zero COVID strategy, wanting to keep the virus completely out, which they did manage to do for a stretch, but that has certainly not been the case for the past few months. You know, Omicron, I think, just proved too overwhelming for that strategy. And what I'm honestly I guess there's two main things that I'm worried about there is that people are still being asked to adhere to these pretty extreme behavioral measures. You know, they can't go outside. It's really having a severe impact on the economy and people's mental and physical well-being. And the virus still is slipping through. And, you know, the other big problem is absolutely not enough of the older population is vaccinated. And we know that the vaccines that they're using, while they're decent vaccines, they're certainly nowhere near performing as well as the mRNA vaccines we have here. Boosters aren't widespread, and, you know, the population has some immunity, but it's absolutely not maxing out on the immunity that they could have.
So let's just be very specific in this kind of dilemma. You know, if China lets go of its zero COVID policies entirely, given the vaccination level among seniors, the numbers seem to suggest that we could lose millions and millions of people.
I think that is exactly the bind the country is in. You know, it's almost this bizarre and horrific sunk cost fallacy. Like, they have done the zero COVID strategy. They have not maybe prepared as much as they could in terms of vaccination because zero COVID was working. And now they're in this bind where they're in a very precarious spot. They, you know, release one pedal, they're going to get massive, massive, massive disease and death. If they, you know, release the other, or I guess keep holding the other, which is maintaining the zero COVID policy, it's just not going to be sustainable. Either way, it seems like this dam is about to break. And, you know, the best thing we can hope is that they do get vaccination rates up before this dam breaks to the degree that we're expecting it to.
It doesn't appear to be happening from everything I'm reading. Do you know otherwise?
No.
So it's really this very, very odd situation where it started there. It's boomerang back. They're locking people down. The reports from even Western reporters who are in the country about the really kind of severe nature of this lockdown is startling. If anyone wants to read any of those accounts, these are not large residences where people are living in, and being not able to go outside at all for any reason is pretty dramatic. I mean, there's something like 40% of the country is on lockdown from what I saw. And then the spillover effects, well, I think we'd all agree, secondary to talk about relative to the human life, of how much of the economy, of the world economy, is comes out of China. There is, you know, you look at sort of what's happening in the kind of global stock markets, to just pick an indicator of what people are seeing. You know, there are a lot of economists I've talked to who've said that the world's just not built for China to be at a standstill, that everything from supply chains to food supply to everything else is at risk because everything now is so global.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is one thing that we've confronted repeatedly throughout this pandemic. You know, we have this global economy, we have markets that work globally, but we have not really had a unified front when it comes to public health and infection prevention. And so we're seeing these two things collide in ways that are incredibly tragic. I don't know what's going to happen next. It is not going to be good.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive. From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together. This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between. Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us. So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
So what should we be paying attention to now? I mean, that's kind of a sense of what's going on around the globe. And as with everything, it's been very hard to predict kind of one season to the next what happens. And it feels like there are so many unanticipated consequences of what could come out of China. The reason we went into this conversation is because what comes next could be related to some combination of what's happening in North Korea, China, South Africa, other parts of the world that, you know, are hard to predict now, but will be easy to explain after the fact. How are you processing it all? And what are you thinking about as the things we should be watching for?
I guess there's two categories of things that I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about what the virus could be doing right now and what we could be doing right now and maybe are not. To start with the virus, I mean, I don't know where all of these variants are coming from. No one knows exactly for sure, but there are some interesting things to talk about. You know, I certainly think the motif here is that the more the virus is allowed to copy itself and mutate, the worse that is. That could be happening in us. So the more cases we have, the more infections we have, that is going to be worse for us. And exactly as you've been pointing out, you know, growing immunity does put different pressures on the virus. We're walking it into a corner, so it's slipping around us and finding somewhere else to play. It's also worth keeping in mind that, you know, the more we let it spread among us, the more it has a chance to jump into other species, kind of explore the space there, and pop variants out that way. What's really fascinating about what's going on with Omicron is that there does seem to be at least some reservoir somewhere, whether it's in the wild or in a person who doesn't have a fully functional immune system. And it's making it very easy for the virus to just pop variants out at this astonishing clip. And, you know, the way to prevent that is to prevent cases from going as crazy as they have been.
And as you say, not just incremental changes. There's something going on which is allowing this to make pretty significant changes in the spike.
Right. And we're not quite sure what that is, like why whatever environment it's hanging out in is so permissive. But, you know, certainly the more shots on goal this virus is allowed to take, the more it's going to make. But I think it also is worth pointing out that it doesn't seem like this virus needs to make that many changes to really slip around some of our defenses. And other coronaviruses have definitely shown this capacity as well. You know, you squeeze the virus in one part of its anatomy, it sort of bulges out in another, to draw a sort of clumsy analogy here. But it is a really flexible virus, and I think we just can't take that for granted.
So that's one of the things you're looking at. The second thing you mentioned was how we're responding.
Right. And, you know, definitely worth looking at what the U.S. is and is not doing right now. I think, you know, thinking about what we just talked about with North Korea and China, those are unsustainable ways to manage the pandemic and what we are hopefully working toward after the pandemic. I think these are the things that we need to start thinking about. How are we going to handle future outbreaks? How are we going to, you know, live sustainably with this virus? Living with COVID is not letting it run roughshod over us. It's having a plan. What do we do when cases start rising? You know, how do we reckon with when cases rise but hospitalizations don't? When is the right time to act, and what can people tolerate, especially after 2 years of, you know, so much suffering? You know, there aren't easy answers to these questions, but something that I am always thinking about is not just what tools we have available to us, but, you know, to whom they are available. I think there is this common tendency to sort of look at where we are at the pinnacle. You know, what do people have access to when they have access to everything? If the people who have the access to the most resources can get tests and Paxlovid and excellent masks, and they have vaccines and boosters, and, you know, they can get, you know, A-plus care at the hospital that is 1 mile from their house, that's phenomenal. Their risk is relatively low. But what does that say about everyone who is, you know, 8, 9, 10 degrees removed from that? I'm constantly thinking about, you know, the least common denominator. if we don't have those same resources accessible to at least, you know, some partial degree, that is what defines what the pandemic looks like in a country. It is the denominator, the foundation, the bottom of this mountain where we have to be looking. And the goal is to elevate the bottom, not just keep pushing the top up. I think if we don't do that, we are just going to exacerbate the disparities between these groups. And that is what is going to keep outbreaks going. That is what is going to fuel, I think, more suffering for much, 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 much longer.
What you say is true. And of course, it's true at a time when the vaccines are free to everybody in this country. Presuming they could even, you know, they can access them, they at least don't have to pay for them. You know, we're now looking at least a potential future where if Congress doesn't act, that will no longer be the case. And the resources that go into not only producing a vaccine and distributing it, but making people aware of it, getting it into doctors' offices, educating people, because as we know, you know, we can't live with a vaccine that's 60% effective taken by 30% of the public, right? That's just not enough. So the strategy of equity is a strategy that's not just good for some people. That's a strategy that's good for everybody.
Yeah.
When it comes to fighting an infectious disease.
Right. And I mean, the funding question is huge right now. You know, we're not allocating enough domestically, and we're absolutely not allocating enough internationally. I think there will continue to be, you know, pieces that move between countries. And, you know, if we don't pay attention to the global picture, the U.S. will continue to suffer because of it. But, you know, the plan going forward, I am incredibly nervous about it. I don't even know what is going to happen this fall. Will there be enough vaccines for the people who really, really, really need them, the people who really, really need them? And then what about the rest of us? It is a pretty scary time. Like, if this virus is with us permanently, our response to it has to be with us permanently. And I'm not sure I see that right now.
Right. That leads me to believe, which is why I think I started the conversation this way, that our response is very science dependent. Because we're very much not shown a willingness to do very much that requires any amount of sacrifice that's hard. Particularly now that most people feel individually like they've got ways to keep themselves alive. When people felt like, you know, their life was threatened, or someone in their household's life was threatened, they maybe responded differently. But this feeling of feeling more safe now means that the tools available are really limited to, you know, what can be done scientifically and then what we're willing to pay for and distribute. Is that wrong?
It's an interesting way to think about it. I think, you know, there are things to absolutely focus on the science and technology side. Knowing that, you know, human behavior is an incredibly big factor here, I think it absolutely is worth paying attention to some interventions that could have public health benefit without asking people to take a ton of individual behaviors and individual decisions that will sort of tax people's pandemic psychological budget every day. Ventilation, making treatments free and available, making tests free and available, increasing booster uptake. You get one shot a year and you're kind of set for a while. I mean, booster uptake in this country is a disaster. As you know, we only have a third of the country there. These sort of base level protections, I think, are what will help raise the foundation that I talk about. It will lower risk across the board if we're actually able to distribute those things equitably. And we could get to a point where, you know, we are pretty much never asking people to put on a mask, mandate masks, things like that. But I think that's going to take enormous long-term investment. And we do have to make sure that that supply is there. But I don't think we can ever fully take the behavioral aspect off the table. Like, you know, there was a really interesting analysis done a few months ago looking at, you know, which countries did well during this pandemic and why. And, you know, trust in government, trust in people's community members, trust in each other makes a huge, huge, huge difference. And that is incredibly fractured in this country. I think if we don't have trust in leadership, if we don't have a communal mindset that makes me think about not just how I'm doing, but how you are doing, how my neighbor is doing, we're not going to have a sustainable policy going forward. I mean, it's very clear that individual decision-making and, you know, me for me does not work when the threat is collective like this. It is going to stay collective. It is going to be, you know, continually collective, especially knowing that, you know, we have these disparities and who has access to what and who is safe from what. If we don't, again, think about the foundation, we are going to get ourselves into a lot of trouble, because if the virus gets worse, that is something that affects all of us, even those at the very top who have access to everything right now.
Oh, 100%. So I'd say that this was on edge. And I'd say this was kind of a relatively pessimistic conversation, would you say?
Not one of my cheeriest, no.
And look, I think we're calling it as we see it. I don't think we're trying to color this more or less optimistic or pessimistic. But the outlook is what I think I find so fascinating, just looking around the globe as we've covered today. It's always insightful to have you in here. I don't think we should manufacture any optimism that doesn't exist, but I will leave you with an opportunity for the last word. If there are things you're looking at that we didn't cover, or that give us reason to be a little more hopeful than we've covered.
There is one thing I am really excited about, and that is next month, hopefully getting two EUAs for Moderna and Pfizer's vaccines for kids under 5. I don't think that is going to end the pandemic on its own, but it will offer hopefully hundreds of thousands of kids, millions of kids, the opportunity to have some protection, have some immunity, especially for the kids who are too little to be masking and, you know, for whom parents have been worrying for years on end now.
For those parents, every day is a century between now and when that can happen. We still got a lot of challenges we got to work on. Thank you for coming in the bubble again. It's such a delight when you do. You did a great job explaining to everybody the current state of affairs.
Always a pleasure to be here, and sorry I couldn't be a little cheerier today.
It wasn't you. It was actually as much me than anything else.
All right, I'll let you take the blame for this one.
On Wednesday, we are going to find out what we need to know about monkeypox. You've probably seen it in the headlines. What should you be worried about? What should you just be aware of? We're going to talk to Anne Ramoyne, who is the director of the Center for Global Immigrant Health at UCLA. She is an expert on monkeypox. We're grateful that she has chosen our show to come talk about things. Friday, we've got a Friday conversation where we are going to talk about one of the things I know that's on everybody's mind, which is the price of gas, the price of food, the availability of gas, the availability of food, particularly important going into Memorial Day weekend. Next week, Beto O'Rourke, who is running for governor in the state of Texas, we're going to talk to him about his race and the issues that are emerging there. General Gustav Perna, oh, I'm so excited for this. General Perna was the head of Operation Warp Speed. He is a 4-star general, amazing guy, inspiring guy. Larry Summers. It's going to be on to talk about the economy. He is the former Secretary of Treasury. Scott Kirby, who's the CEO of United Airlines. We're going to talk about pilot shortage and travel and transportation issues around masking and many of the other things that impact us as we head into the summer. So very excited for all those shows. Glad you're staying with us. Look, your job now is to very simply have a great Tuesday. And we'll see you Wednesday. Thank you for listening to In the Bubble. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Harris, and Kyle Sheely produce our show, and they're great. Our mix is by Noah Smith and James Barber, and they're great too. Steve Nelson is the Vice President of Weekly Content, and he's okay too. And of course, the ultimate bosses, Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax. The executive produced the show, and we love him dearly. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media, where you can also get a transcript of the show, and you can find me at Ace Lavitt on Twitter. If you like what you heard today, why don't you tell your friends to listen as well and get them to write a review. Thanks so much. Talk to you next time.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Elise Myers. I'm a content creator and comedian. You might know me from TikTok. Why am I in your ears right now? Well, that's a great question. I would love to tell you. I have a new podcast called Funny Because It's True. On my show, I'll be interviewing comedians, pop culture icons, and also just people I find really funny. We'll be talking about the awkward moments that keep you awake at night. Because if you don't laugh, you cry, right? Okay, Funny Because It's True. Out now wherever you get your podcasts.